to the Good Grief Conversation. I'm your host, Janet Jones, and you're listening to UK Health Radio. This programme brings you honest, gritty, emotional and inspiring conversation around a subject that affects all of us, yet is still very much taboo. So join me now for this inspiring Good Grief Conversation. Today's guest is Jude Hill. Jude spent 20 years avoiding the grief of her four-year-old son, who sadly died of a brain tumour. Often, people don't face their grief, and I think that this is largely because it is misunderstood and is an uncomfortable conversation, which is why the Good Grief Conversation is so important. Even when people do talk about loss and grief, they don't really know what to say because they too, at some time in their life, will have pushed grief away. And the best they can offer, which was actually said to me just recently, was, "You just get used to it." Well, that isn't good enough for me. You see, we're not encouraged to speak openly about grief and death. It is like discussing sex. It happens to everyone. It's an incredibly confusing emotional experience, yet it is largely a taboo subject. A dirty and uncomfortable subject. You see, I believe that grief is beautiful, but in the ugliness of the changes that it brings. And I believe that deep underneath the sadness and pain, there is a diamond. A gift. Jude is going to share her story of how she found her gift. Now, as always, I ask my guests for a gift for you. And all of those gifts are put into the podcast extras that are available to all the listeners. They are available to you anytime you like. All you do is just head over to thegoodgriefconversation.com and you can join the podcast extras community and you can receive many gifts from my guests and they are always there and they build up. It is a fantastic resource to open up the conversation of grief and open up the conversation of living more fully and living better, you know, with your grief situation rather than just getting used to it. So I do know that Jude has put a lovely gift in there to help you to find your gift, your diamond also. So just head over there. That is to thegoodgriefconversation.com. However, don't go there just yet. Sit back and listen to Jude's story and how she eventually found her diamond. So Jude, welcome to the Good Grief Conversation. It's lovely for you to spare some time to have a chat with me.
Lovely to be here.
Yeah, it's great. We were chatting and you were sharing your story with me just the other day, but can you just briefly go over your story again? You know, what happened to you in your own words?
So where do I start? So that was back in, I suppose it begins in around 1990 really, when my son was 18 months old and he got diagnosed with cancer, a brain tumour. So short version of that, he had an operation, had chemotherapy and radiotherapy that he went through. We thought all was going well. And then on one of his 6-month checkups, we got told that the tumour had come back larger than it was before. So there wasn't anything they could do. They'd basically done everything before. And because it was even bigger now, then it was terminal cancer and he'd got a few months to live. So that's where the story begins. And then I finally lost him in August of 1992 when he was 4.5. So that's where my story begins. So how did I cope with grief? I mean, the world was a very different place then. There wasn't the internet, so there wasn't all the access we've got now in you know, online support and things. So I had quite a small family. We'd moved back with my mum and dad whilst I was nursing him through the last few months, and with their help.
You were very young at the time as well.
Yeah, I was only 24 at the time then. So I did have my own flat where I lived with Adam before. So yeah, we'd moved back home with them. But then I did move back out, and I sort of threw myself into work to deal with things, because I'd always been, I had some sort of natural resilience in me to a degree, I suppose. And my parents were a bit older for that era, so they'd always had that thing of, you know, you just get on with life, and a bit like, you know, the war mentality, you know, you get on with what life serves you and things. And I wasn't a great one for showing my emotions or expressing my emotions that way. I did used to keep things in and was quite private. So I went back to work, and I got one of my friends to basically tell everyone, because everyone knew that I'd been on in and out of work because of what had been going on, and time off with him while I was nursing him. But I just, like, if anyone said anything, I was just that fraction away from completely breaking down and being a mess. So it was just, I could sort of go in and put that mask on and be someone else, and just, I suppose, in a way, be a little bit robotic with work and just get on with that. But it was a distraction from the pain, where as soon as you weren't thinking about that, you know, you'd go home and then, yeah, you'd be a mess. You know, you'd think, how could you deal with this? And I suppose my biggest, or two biggest things of moving on, one was the fact that obviously, he was in that tremendous amount of pain. And I thought, well, I'm only 24. I've got another 40, 50 years left on this earth. So, and just the thought of staying in that pain, I couldn't see how I'd ever get out of that pain, how it would ever feel any less. But equally, I couldn't imagine living, especially that long length of time, in that pain. So that sort of pushed me to force myself to sort of get on with, you know, life or what's normal and that sort of thing. Again, where I was quite young, I didn't have close friends or family that had children themselves. So my friends were still coming round and things. And I was always one of those people that would think of how someone else is going to take something when you're sharing something, which was part of me keeping my emotions in. So although I talked a little bit about what was going on for me with them, not a great deal, and they didn't want me sort of being stuck in the flat, you know, getting to that depression stage and that. So they encouraged me to come out with them at the weekends, as the normal average 24-year-old does. And I went, because again, it was another distraction. Otherwise, if I was at home, all you've got to think about is that. And then you get caught in that sort of wallowing in the loss, and you go down to that deep hole where you can't get out.
Yes. But I notice in your book, you refer, and your book is called?
So it's Sadness to Sunshine, A Compassionate Guide for Bereaved Parents, Empowering Them to Find Happiness Again.
Yeah. And I've read a bit of it. I did say I haven't managed to read all of it before our interview, but I will go back to it. And, you know, you cover lots of topics in there, which is great. But one thing you talk about is the grieving process, the Kubler-Ross grieving process. And I guess if your friends are distracting you and work is distracting you all the time, then it's difficult to process it or go through this process.
And I think that's the thing. I think in that model, and I think even later she said it herself, it wasn't supposed to be a linear process, but the way it was talked about a lot was, oh, you know, you go through the initial phases of the shock and the disbelief and the denial of what's going on. And then you move through the other phases, finally into acceptance sort of thing. Whereas what I think my model that I've done in there, you can be feeling all those things at one point. You know, we all know it's happened when we've lost someone like that, you know, but it's just, you still can have that moment where you wake up the next day and you just think they're going to phone you, or they're going to walk back in the door or something. So you're sort of back to stage one. So it overlaps. And, you know, from people I've spoke to, you know, in my work and in life and that sort of thing, grief is a very messy process and that. And as I discovered with what happened later sort of thing, when it come back 20 plus years to rise up within me, that if you don't process it in some ways and you don't, you know, share what your emotions are and deal with those emotions, then they basically get trapped in your body. And even if it's, you don't think it's directly affecting you, it's affecting you in so many ways in life and holding you back and relationships.
And backaches and so many things. I'm reading a book at the moment, something like The Body Keeps Score, I think is what it's called.
Oh, yeah.
And it is just about that. If you don't deal with things, your body is keeping the score. It's not going away. And until you work through things and acknowledge your body's holding them. So it is important to follow some pattern or, you know, gain the knowledge, I think, is the important thing. I mean, I guess, you know, like you said, you were 24. It's not today where there's so much access to information, and which is fantastic. You feel so less alone. You must have felt so very alone, being the only one in your group who had a child and who'd lost a child, and then your parents saying, come on, you know, just get up, brush yourself down and get on with the war mentality, which I'm sure was all they knew how to do. And that was them loving you and encouraging you to live when the worst things happened.
That was the thing. And it was also the fact, because Adam was really so brave, and he just, like, throughout his whole 3-year journey with cancer, he just accepted everything and never really complained. Probably, you know, that age, didn't understand a lot of it. But, you know, I remember one funny time when he was at nursery and he said to one of the other little boys, oh, what hospital do you go to? Because he just thought it was a normal part of life. He'd been in and out of hospital since 18 months. So, you know, he just thought everyone went there, you know, and that was quite normal to him. So, you know, your daily normal can be, yeah, whatever it is. So, yeah, it was for him as well. I think there was that. You know, I didn't know it now. I know it's sort of like my sole guidance, but at the time, at that young age, I wasn't really into spirituality, didn't really sort of get it or anything. So
again, not as accessible in, when did you say, 1992?
I lost him, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, not the conversation wasn't as broad back then. It's a different day today, and thank goodness it is. You know, I lost my dad in 1994. He committed suicide, and there was no conversation. And, you know, I had a breakdown 6 years later, wrecked my marriage, all kinds of things. You know, it's like, oh, if there was a conversation somewhere, it would have been such a different story. But the story is the story. It is as it is.
That's it. And, it, you know, it's some of what makes you stronger, what you do go through, but it's like my passion now is to help other people that are in the more semi-early stages with a way of expressing their emotions and sort of learning from my mistake in that sense of holding it back in. Because, like, in the early years, I just wanted to feel close to him, obviously, as we all do when we lose someone special, and used to, you know, spend a lot of my spare time sitting at the grave, because again, at that age, in my logical mind, you know, that was where he was, at the graveside. So I needed to go there to feel close to him, but I never did feel close to him. It just, you know, enhanced even more that obviously he was never coming back by being there. So, and I carried that on even, so 6 years later and 8 years later, I had my other two sons after losing him. And, you know, from babies, they used to go there. So again, they grew up knowing it was quite normal. And by that time, I'd actually lost my dad, my mum as well. So my dad died just under 2 years after Adam died of a sudden fatal heart attack. And then I lost my mum 18 months later. So when we were going there, my sons were actually visiting their brother and both of their grandparents there as well.
Yeah, I do find, I mean, my son was cremated, so at the moment he's still living with me, but my mum and dad were both buried. And I do find that when I go there, it's nice, actually, just taking that time out to be with them, even though I know that they aren't there. But I think going, it makes you give your time specifically to them. Whereas quite often we get so busy in life and, you know, once the sort of the protection around your grief is probably a good way of describing it. Once that comes and you're able to function again, we get busy again. And then you go, oh, I haven't taken the time out to be with them. And I find I still need to do that with Murray. I need time out to sit with him.
Yeah, definitely. I think in those early years, and I think if going there makes you feel comfortable, then, you know, that's good and it's nice. And sometimes, like you say, it is just that quiet space where you go and you can just, you can still have that conversation. You know, that's the thing as well. We just want to see, touch, speak to them again. And, you know, that's part of my message as well. You know, you can still talk to them. They're not actually gone. And, you know, you can do that in any ways. You can just speak out loud as though they were still in the same room and have a conversation. You know, you can journal to them. One of the things I often suggest to people I work with is, you know, do a love journal and that sort of thing. So, you know, tell them how much you love them or tell them about what else is happening with siblings and things. And it's all part of keeping them part of the family, which is another thing I sort of tried to do, because I suppose I'd had that interim period of, you know, 6 years before Nathan was born and he was a baby, probably 8 years before he was understanding anything, you know, of any significance really. But they, you know, they grew up knowing about their brother from birth and he was talked about within the family. But it was almost like two separate lifetimes, because, as you say, things move on and, you know, I changed jobs. So people from, you know, my old work, new jobs, you know, you don't introduce yourself as someone, oh yeah, and I lost my son 8 years ago, you know. So it's not something that you're necessarily obviously hiding. And
it just fades, doesn't it? You know, it's,
yeah.
Which is really sad when you think of the impact that that child has had on you as the mother. And also, he's still part of you. And it almost feels like, how do people get to fully know you unless they know of that also?
Yeah, and I know it's a big thing for, you know, other parents that I've spoke to, and that is their main thing. You know, they want people to talk about their child, and especially in the early days when someone will talk about them, then you will invariably get upset. So sometimes it takes a strong person from being the other person there to be able to deal with that amount of emotion that's coming out. But that's another reason why I think if people find a way and get some of the help from whoever they resonate with out there to let go of those emotions and clear some of the more negative and sad emotions, then that actually gives them the strength to speak about their child. And it's that, quite confidence is the right word, but, you know, for me now, I know I'm speaking about him obviously a lot more in the work that I do, but, you know, just in private life as well, you know, it sort of comes out and random conversations, and it's just easier because you've cleared that underlying grief that's in there. So because you've actually processed and dealt with that, you can speak about them. And that's the thing now, you know, I'm able to remember the happy times. You know, that's one of my favorite photos that I've got, again, because it wasn't a digital age where you had a, you know, your phone, hence camera, with you all the time. Then I haven't got loads, but it was when he was ill, we went to stay with a friend and we went to Madame Tussauds, and he really loved Batman, so he had a photo, there's me and him with the Batman waxworks at Madame Tussauds. And, you know, before looking at that photo would have brought back, oh my god, you know, that was when he was ill, when I was losing him and that. Whereas now I just remember how much he enjoyed that weekend, so I can remember it with happy memories, because I've taken away the energetic charge of those deep raw emotions that you've got. If you process them, they're still there, and you're still obviously sad that, you know, you've lost your child or whoever it is, but you can talk about them and, you know, you can reminisce and remember the happy times and be grateful for the years and the time that you had with that person, rather than be transfixed on all of the times that you didn't have. And, you know, especially with a child sort of thing, you know, you've got, you know, you plan out their whole life in one way or another.
Well, yes, you do. You take them for granted. You take life for granted that, of course, they'll always be there. But it doesn't necessarily take 22 years, as you've discovered, you know, with your path it did, but it doesn't necessarily need to be that, which is why I set up the good grief conversation, really, because personally, I think it's more about emotional intelligence. And when you are more emotionally aware before things happen, because things will happen to us, not necessarily as severe as our experiences, but, you know, things will happen in life. So if we are more emotionally attuned, because I would say, you know, grief, this is my experience, it's a paradox. On one side, you've got the sadness and pain, but on the very same side of the very same coin, you've also got the gratitude for your child, the funny stories, the funny memories, and you bring those up and they bring sadness at the same time, you know, in the early stages. And then eventually, you know, that sadness will subside, but it'll rise up every so often, but the funny stories can remain. And I was just with a neighbor earlier today and we were talking about some funny stories with my son. And, you know, it was lovely. I mean, we both ended up fighting back the tears. But again, that's okay because it's part of the deal, you know, part of the deal. And it's all okay. I think that's very important for people to get that it's okay. I noticed in your book, you were talking about the depression phase. I know you break the process down, but one of them where you talk about the depression stage, reading through that list of things that you describe as depression, I also thought that also describes extreme sadness. I personally think extreme sadness is different than depression. I think I went through extreme sadness. I had every one of those symptoms. So within the depression, so you talk about lowered self-esteem. Well, I'll be honest, I didn't really care much about myself at the time because I blasted apart. So there wasn't much of me left. My sleeping patterns, yes, they were disturbed, even though I felt I could sleep for Britain. Feelings of worthlessness and guilt. The worthlessness, yes. I'm not sure about the guilt, though, because I look back and think I could not have loved my son more. So I didn't have the guilt. The motor skills may be slower and limited. Limited energy. Well, I had no energy at all. Yeah, definitely loss of motivation. I did wonder, actually, if my motivation would ever come back. But just these last few weeks, it has actually started to come back. Fluctuating appetite or weight, definitely had that. I gained weight. I've actually done an interview with a woman called Jenny Tishy, who's a nutritionist, and we talk about food and grief and the inability to enjoy things that once gave you pleasure. Well, I didn't find enjoyment in anything whatsoever. Persistent sad mood, bouts of crying, yes. Small incidents might cause considerable upset. Not sure about that one. And difficulty concentrating and remembering. Oh, yeah, you know, brain completely. I think it felt like my brain was inflamed, is how I would describe what was going on in my physical experience. Difficulty expressing anger. No, I could express my anger all right. Didn't have a problem with that. Turning emotions inward, no, never did that. Again, it probably comes down to your personality, which is actually what you say in your book, isn't it? So my heart is on my sleeve, so my emotions never go inward, much to the disappointment of my other children, I think. So that's what you list as depression. And then later on, you talk about the other faces of grief, of the shock and the disbelief. Most definitely, there was shock and disbelief because Murray was a tragic accident. But how was that for you? Because even though you know this is coming, what is the shock and disbelief side for you?
No, that was one of the things that surprised me at the time. Because as you say, I'd had months to prepare and, you know, you talk yourself into it and, you know, you think, oh, it's going to be okay. But then, you know, when it actually happens, I mean, I was really fortunate in that sense. When he finally went, our Macmillan nurse was actually on one of her standard visits. So she was actually there. So she sort of took charge of, you know, knew what was happening and the practical things. But like, I remember the few days afterwards, I was just in shock that he'd gone, even though, you know, he'd been ill for 3 years plus. And, you know, I'd known for several months that, you know, had the terminal diagnosis. And it wasn't like I was in denial. I was still positive, but obviously, and you could see him getting weaker over those months. So, you know, it was obvious it was coming. So I thought I had, in my head, I think that's the difference. In my head, I'd accepted it. And I think that's the way people deal with the acceptance after the loss as well. So in your head, you know that they've passed away, you know, you've had the funeral, the cremation, and you know it's happened, but it's just that moment where you then wake up and it's like you suddenly remember that they're not coming back, sort of thing, you know, because you've just gone into a different theta wave in your sleep and you've just come back like that. But yeah, it was definitely, I remember at the time thinking, why am I so shocked, because I knew it was coming, but it's just when it actually happens, it's like you get steamrolled all over again.
And I guess it's the void as well, isn't it, that happens when that personality has been taken away from your life. It creates this void that it takes time to fill it or find some meaning in that void.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. It, you know, there's the head level of acceptance, and then there's the heart level of acceptance. So that's where I am now, and that's what gives me the peace that, you know, I couldn't change anything that happened, but it's just it has, and it's that sort of full acceptance of it and seeing it in a different way. Like I now see that what I always say is, whoever you've lost, they're in your heart forever, and you've got that soul bond and that connection with them, and no one can take that away. And you know, my belief now is that when someone passes on, their energy that was living in that body as the person you knew, so in Adam, in my case, then just goes to, you know, wherever it is, and you can fit that into whatever religion or spiritual beliefs you've got to that, but it's their energy, and then they're on a really high vibration. So if you're stuck in that grief and that deep sadness, which is right at the low end of the vibrational scale, that's why you feel more separated from them and you can't connect with them. Whereas once, like now, I've gone through all this healing work and brought myself out of it, I'd sort of masked it for the 20 plus years when I hadn't worked on those emotions, where I just pushed them down, and it was like this sort of darkness that I was carrying around with me, even fooling myself that, you know, I thought I'd got through it as much as you ever can with something like that. Whereas now it's just that, like, I can connect where I am. You know, we were talking earlier about going to the graveside. I can just zone in and tune in wherever I am and just feel connected to him vibrationally. So it's a different sort of connection. And, you know, like my other sons, they never met their brother. But when I did the launch for my book, that was when it really showed up. So the older one was in tears at the end of my little talk, and his girlfriend had to take him out into the corridor where we were holding the party. And then my younger son went off to meet his friends before the evening had finished, and then he phoned me up, and all I just heard was the words where he said, "Oh, I've hit." And I said, "What, has someone hit you? Have you been hit in your car?" or sort of thing. And he went, "No, it's emotionally hit him the night." And he was saying this was about 11 o'clock at night. And will the grave be open? Like, because he felt like he wanted to go to the, you know. And I'm like, "No, darling, it's going to be shut now," sort of thing. Like, and I was like, "Oh, do you want me to come and get you?" And he said, "No, I'm all right. He's going to stay at his friend's." And then he couldn't even go to work the next day. So I had to phone up his part-time job at the time and try and explain this slightly weird situation of why he wasn't going to be in work then. But, you know, they'd sort of accepted it, knowing it. But I think it was just all came out that night, you know, hearing some of the Fuller story sort of thing. They've had that connection and they've never even met him. So, you know, that's my big message out there to other people, because that's what brings on all that sadness, is we feel it's our lack of connection with whoever it is we've lost. But it's just a different connection you can have with them now. And if you can get to that place, then that makes it easier, and that makes you be able to come to that full acceptance of it, that gives you that peace, and just knowing that they're still there with you, just in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, even when I, in fact, probably in the early days, I had a stronger connection with Murray, a heart connection. I carry him with me every day. I don't, you know, and in nice ways. But I think it probably more comes, it's when acceptance kicks in. And I say kick in because I don't think that there is a time that you can put on acceptance. And it's a weird thing. In fact, I'm going to speak to another author next week about acceptance. And what are the stages? Yes, you can talk to yourself about accepting, and But somehow it's as though one day the penny just drops when you've gone through it enough times that this is done, that they're not coming back. I now need to accept this different scenario that I'm in, this different story of mine. What are your thoughts on the process of acceptance, if there is a process to it?
A lot of it is working with your timeline, because I think a lot of people where, and I know it was something I found more difficult, I think, in some ways when my other sons came along. And again, social media can be good and bad. Yes, there's more help out there and access to groups and that sort of thing. But it's also the fact of, like, for instance, when we've got September coming up with the children, you know, everyone's going to be posting their photos of their children going back to school, or maybe even going back to school after lockdown and things, you know, and or definitely the September time of school, I know, is a big area. And, you know, if you've just, you know, if your son or daughter should have been starting school that year or going up to secondary school or whatever it was, then that's really going to hit home. And it's things like that that bring it to more realization. I know when, you know, my boys got to the age when Adam was sort of thing, it was like, oh, and then it was a bit strange when they did do the things, you know, that he would have done, like starting, he went to play group, but he never actually got to proper school, you know. And yeah, it was just a little bit surreal in those times, really. But I think it's having a way as well of coping with the trigger points as well. So when you are triggered by something, you've got some sort of technique, whatever it is, that can take yourself out of it. So I think that's why, you know, it's important that people do seek help, or, you know, find some way of what they're doing to be able to cope with that. Because I think that's the thing that keeps people stuck in either whatever you want to call it, that deep sadness or that depression stage, understandably, especially when it's, you know, loss of a child. You know, nobody gets it around you. You feel so alone, and you know, you're not getting that help, you haven't got a way of coping with those things and moving on, and you've got that whole timeline of what you imagined, you know, whatever age, whether you use them really young like that, you know, you've got school and that, or if you lose them at a slightly older age, you know, you would think, oh, one day they would have been getting married, and then children of your friends or family are reaching that age, and you know, everyone else's child is getting married, so you know, that could be several years later and having children, and then, you know, you might think, oh, I'm never going to have grand, especially if it was an only child, you know, I'm never going to have, and you're getting the whole mara of that sort of thing, but not being transfixed on those dates, you know, it's working through all of those thoughts and feelings that are individual for everyone that are coming up and processing those, then that helps you deal with it. And then that in the back door brings in acceptance, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it keeps those things smaller rather than letting them take hold and overtake you. But I guess the timeline is actually forever, because it's a child. It's the opposite way. So you, like with a parent, you expect at some point in your life, you are going to lose a parent. All your friends, they lose their parents. You're going to lose your parent. So somewhere in the mind, there's a, oh, this is normal. And you don't really go through your life. I mean, you do in the early stages when you've lost a parent and say somebody gets married. And it's like, oh, you know, my mom should be here, et cetera, et cetera. But that doesn't go on completely for the rest of your life. Oh, and that'll probably be a different conversation. But with a child, because it's like, it's almost a backward loss, you'd never expect it to happen. Like when you're alive, you just assume that this child's going to grow up and there are going to be these celebrations. So therefore, when they're gone, because it's a backward, that it's almost like those celebrations or the potentials, they are showing up.
And it's getting transfixed on those dates. I don't know if it helped, because I wasn't much of a dates person, but it was more for me. It was silly things, like I'd see a toy in the shop that he would have liked or something, and you know, that would set me off, or a certain song on the radio or something like that. Or I couldn't watch, like one of my trigger points was I couldn't watch any like children's hospital TV programs. As soon as they come on, I would have had to have turn them over. But now I've done the work and I've done that, and I say, where my initial stages when I was just dealing with my grief by myself, I think it was just my own inner mindset work that I was doing that I didn't even realize was mindset work at the time. It was just, you know, now I think it was my soul guiding me, or Adam guiding his energy, guiding me through it to help me. But yeah, it was just on a head level But then it's different on a, you know, a heart when you're dealing with those emotions, like particularly with the, you know, loss of a child. People say, I've got a broken heart, and it's, you know, a common phrase that it will never heal. But energetically, I believe you can heal your heart if you do the work, and then it's just accepting that it's that different sort of connection you've got with them rather than that. All a mix of things, it sounds. It's hard to just put it into a few words.
I know when it's time limited, such a huge subject, and I've got a limited time. So let's now take a walk into the sunshine, because your book is called Sadness to Sunshine. So tell us about the sunshine bit, because when it does initially happen to you, you don't believe the sun will ever shine again.
No, I think I'd got sort of halfway there in those early years. It was from a bit of, you know, like a pushing forward energy and the sort of almost like the stiff upper lip, you know, the typical British phase of getting on with it, and but masking a lot of things as well and not dealing with those underlying things. And then like when my other sons come along, it was a lot of thinking about them. It was like Christmas time, for instance. Obviously, I'd be really sad, you know, their older brother should be there with them and that, but he wasn't. But I'd try and be all happy and a lovely Christmas for them. So I've sort of, I'd got halfway to that sadness, but it was still a little bit of a pretend. Again, like in the early days when I was going out with my friends, so to the outside world, it probably looked like I was having a great time, but it was just, you know, the alcohol was masking the pain and I was just pretending to be okay for everyone else. And then life goes on and, you know, you're in that okay thing. And then it wasn't until back in 2016 when the grief froze up and then I did all this work to realise it. I just realised on a whole new level that there was so much more out there. There was, you know, you can have those real deep feelings of joy. And, you know, I did at other times, like when my other sons were born and, you know, when they've done other things as they were growing up and hit their milestones. But it was always before doing that release work, it was always, even if nobody else knew outwards, it was tinged with that sadness of, oh, but Adam should be here as well, you know, or they should have met their brother and, you know, all of that. But it was just getting to that other level that there is that way, and it's just that inner feeling of being able to feel true happiness again rather than just sort of pretending to be happy with your friends that are taking me out, you know, at that stage, or, you know, happy with sons and, you know, my husband at the time and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And I guess happy just acknowledging that there is this sadness. So how do you then live, you know, what is it you do where you live fully and there is no sadness anymore?
So I think the big thing for me is just feeling that connection. I think that was what was missing before, you know, like I say, when I used to go and visit the grave, you know, we did that for years and that sort of thing. It was just that there's still that obvious thing that he's missing. And obviously he's still missing physically and he hasn't physically done the things, you know, like growing up and got married and all the rest of it and that sort of thing. But it's just having that warmth and that presence of that connection with him in a different way. And that just brings light, not just because that's happened, but and it's just that energetic release, like the charge of the emotions and being able to speak about things that have happened, even if sometimes, you know, there's a bit of tears. It's not like it's all totally not emotional when I'm talking about things that happen, but it's not got that severity of things where you're going to talk about it and then you're going to be completely break down and crying and that's going to drop your level of feeling as well. So it was like after I look back at that point over the last 20 years, if you'd had averaged out, you know, the high points, you know, like when my other sons are born and when they've done things and achieved stuff, and then, you know, the low points and you averaged it out, I probably would have been living on the neutral line, which in some ways for going through, like many of us have been for a major trauma, whatever it is, that's actually not too bad considering, because you've not been kept down in the bottom bit. You know, you've brought yourself so far up out of it. But by doing that other work and releasing the energetic charge around those emotions and actually facing what you're thinking and, you know, releasing any guilt and shame, sadness, any of those lower vibrational emotions that you've been holding in your energy, it just frees and lights you up so you can, you know, truly be happy again, and you're not putting that face on and just pretending to have a good time at whatever event or is happening, you're actually fully embodying all joy and happiness.
I guess that's something that comes in time also. I can't imagine. For me, I mean, I'm not even the full year yet. I mean, we've got his birthday coming up. And, you know, I speak to so many people who go, oh, you know, it's the run-up to these things that's absolutely the worst. Well, it's his birthday in 2 weeks. And actually, I'm quite looking forward to it. I'm going to make a cake. I'm going to get balloons. I'm going to put a happy birthday banner. And we'll bring his energy into the room. And we'll celebrate his birthday with him. So I think it's how you approach something as to what result you get from it.
Yeah, definitely. It's that. And then sometimes it's the phase afterwards. Like, you know, I know a lot of parents I speak to in the early years, other friends and family are like, oh, you know, they remember the anniversary. And then sometimes as it goes on 4 or 5 years plus later, if people are still sort of stuck with their pain because they haven't found a way or someone that can help them through some of it to get them out of it, that's when those symptoms you mentioned earlier about the depression that you said was your deep sadness, I think that's when it becomes depression, when you're long-term stuck suffering them for years and years going on, and that's all that plays on your mind because you've not had either some inner help through yourself of, you know, again, and that will all depend on your growing up and, you know, your natural inner resilience and who you've got to help around you.
And also how much work you've done on yourself previously.
Yeah.
Something going wrong in your life, which is the emotional intelligence that we were chatting about earlier. I see people and I think, you know, you just work on yourself because one day you don't know when you're going to need that inner strength that, you know, build it up beforehand. I'm not saying that life becomes easier, but you do get to be able to handle life better. Do the work before is important. So this, just talk us through what your technique, because I do believe that techniques are very important to know and to practice during these times. Because if we just leave it up to ourselves, then it is easier to stay in that extreme sadness that then will become depression because you've made extreme sadness your habit. Whereas sadness tends to fade. Whereas if you stay focused on it, then it'll become something else. So what is it? What's the technique that you use?
So I use a couple of different techniques. So I use energy alignment and emotional freedom technique quite a lot in my work. So that deals with letting go of the emotions. And I think that's it because most people, like I did in those earlier stages, that are, you know, again, if you've sort of got that somewhere in that inner resilience to push forward and that, you know, you do the mindset work, you know, you talk to yourself, you say, well, there was nothing I could have done. I couldn't have been there. I couldn't have done any more for his care and that sort of thing, but still have some of those gremlins getting in. So it's having some way to do the mindset work. So journaling is quite good because that just gets the thoughts out of your head, but then having a way of getting them to dissipate so that they do go and they don't come back. And then with the others, it's just releasing those emotions. So I sort of mentioned there's like an emotional scale that's been brought out by Dr. David Hawkins, and also Abraham Hicks talks about that as well. So at the bottom, you've got the grief, powerlessness, fear. You know, that's all at the bottom. And then it goes up to through anger, you know, so again, quite a lot of that can recognize this. So although anger can be seen as a negative emotion, if you were at powerlessness and depression, if you're actually able to get up to anger, then that's actually a step forward because at least you're coming up the scale from that. And then if you can learn a way to be able to release that anger, so you're not taking it out in the world and that can dissipate, then you can go up to just be at, you know, contentment. And I think that was where I was talking about on my average. I think that's where I'd sort of got to, you know, I'd had bits above the line and below the line. And then, you know, from the contentment, you build up to hope and then up through being happy and passionate, you know, right up to the top of love, joy and freedom. And I think that's the aim for everyone to just be at that point, you know, and it's not saying that every day I'm there now, you know, there's still everyday things that, you know, stresses and strains that take it out of your life, but just bringing back and just having that awareness. So, you know, like you spoke about emotional intelligence, it's having some way of actually being able to release that. And I think that's the difference. That was what I found, particularly with the energy work. And it was so deep, that first weekend when I found it and did the initial release sort of thing, was that you just feel it go out of your body, you know, like you said at the beginning, you know, emotions, we hold on to them, and then your body literally tightens, and then that's where things happen in your cells, and then that's where it comes out into actual physical ailment or stiffness of the joints, whatever it is, or an illness within there, you know. So yeah, that's where the energetic release is a lot different, because it just releases it in a different way, you know. So before, I'd released it in a mind way, I'd thought, well, no, I couldn't have done anymore, I did everything I could, I followed the advice, he had all the treatments and that, you know, what good would be in angry, like even now, even detoxing your words and what words you use. So I always talk now about Adam's journey with cancer, whereas before I would have been a bit more, oh, cancer. And, you know, I know a lot of parents are like that, you know, oh, I hate cancer, and they'll even use another word there and that, an expletive. And it happened. It's, yes, if we could eradicate cancer, that would be amazing, because that would just save millions of people, literally. But if we can't, this holding on to that hate and that anger for the illness itself isn't doing you any good, and anyhow, it's just going back to then, that's literally eating you up in your body, and or holding on to the guilt, whatever, thinking I should have gone and picked him up that night, and then he wouldn't have had that car accident, or whatever the scenario is. It's just about releasing that, and not just from a head level, from a head, heart and whole body experience level.
Yeah, I refuse to use the word suffer. I don't see myself, I'm not suffering. This is an experience. So if I feel sad, you know, I'm not suffering sadness. I'm experiencing sadness. And that, when you look at it like that, that's when you can see it flow through you. Rather than if you think of yourself suffering, then you get into, that's the easy route into self-pity. And once again, that won't help either. All these things that, as you're talking about, these being energies, those are all low energy feelings, and you don't need them. They don't serve you. What I ask of my guests is to create something for my podcast extras. Just given what we were talking about, when you were talking about like the energy levels, the vibrational levels, would you mind creating like a PDF? And if you, you know, which we'll find this easy, put yourself in the position of my listeners and think, what can I put on one page that is going to make it like the easy thing for somebody to be able to see and take action on? Because action is always the key, because that increases your energy. So action is the thing to do. So if you could do that.
Yeah.
I know that I'm just throwing that at you right now. I know, you know, I would have found that very easy to absorb and to take action on. Sometimes a book can be overwhelming, too much information. So just so we can sink it down. I actually wrote on my wall next to my bed when this happened, and it was like messages as though they're from Murray, really. You know, you've got this, you can do this, you know. Oh gosh. I mean, I didn't believe it at the time, but by keep seeing them and doing it and doing whatever was required, you know, bit by bit, you're just putting another drop into the ocean of healing.
That's the thing, that's the embodiment of affirmations, you know. If you're saying them in your head, but you know, your heart and your gut is saying, what's this load of rubbish, I'm never going to feel happy again, then you've got to get the mind on board, and you need that willpower to, and that initial spark of motivation to want to go through, and then it's bringing the rest of the body in. So again, it's all about getting that energy flowing. And in the early stages, like you say, where you've got no motivation and get out of bed, it's the small things that happen. So my 4 C's model that I use when I work with clients as well. So that's the initial one is care. So you've got to care for yourself physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually, whatever that means to you, spiritually, religiously, whatever your beliefs around there. And then interwoven, the next 2 bits are communication and connection, because we all want to feel that connection. But if you can somehow communicate what you need, even between, say, the husband and wife that have lost a child, and that everyone grieves differently, particularly stereotyping a little bit, but men and women, it's known that a lot of marriages break up. I was a single parent, so I didn't have that issue when I actually lost Adam, but I had it a bit with my mum, with the relationship with her, where we were grieving differently, and something she said once sort of thing I still remember now. But so it's, you know, having that strength, which you don't really have at the time unless you're sort of working through these things, to be able to communicate your need. You can't speak it, write it down for this is what I need, or friends will often offer, what can I do to help? And if you can communicate to them somehow, even if it's writing them a message, oh, just doing the dinner or coming round and cleaning my kitchen for me would help because I haven't got the strength at the moment or something, being able to communicate that, that all helps as that goes on. And then the final C is the fourth C. It's about creating. So it's creating what your new normal will be, and it's creating a new version of the life ahead of you, because particularly with a child, it's ongoing for the whole time. Or even if it's a partner that you've lost, you've had that vision of your next 20, 30 years together or something, and it's all been totally blown apart, but you can create a new future. And it's bringing the energy of that other person with them. As one of my favourite TED Talks, there's a widow and she talks about it, where there's like sort of three people in their marriage. There's her husband that she lost, and then her new husband, but she wouldn't be who she is now, and that's embodied her personality and the new her, and that's the new person that's made the relationship with her new husband. But it's all interlinked, you know. And that's the same thing with my sons. You weren't a replacement for Adam, but they're just like it, and they're just brothers, but just with a different connection.
Yeah, awesome. We've run out of time. I could talk to you all afternoon. That was really brilliant. That was open, it was honest, packed with information and guidance, and I loved it. So yeah, if you could do that PDF, that would be just superb. And we can put that into the podcast extras where people can sign up and they get access to all of that as well.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jude. And I will read more of your book. I've started it. It's great. I will put a link in the podcast extras too, where people can get your book also. I know you're changing a few things, so when you've finished, we will do that.
Yeah.
But thank you very much, Jude. It was an absolute joy.
You're very welcome.
Isn't Jude great? A normal woman who discovered how to turn her darkest times into sunshine. Now, you don't have to wait 20 years, though. You only live once. And in the podcast extras, there are many gifts from my guests and resources, such as recommended apps, meditations, and healing music, all available to you to help you to start your journey to sunshine. Jude has also left a really beautiful gift to help you start that journey too. Just head over to thegoodgriefconversation.com and register. You will see a bright yellow button inviting you to do that. You will also be given the opportunity to support this conversation so that we can keep talking and receiving those valuable gifts. For the price of a paperback or a hardback book, you can help to support us, and your support is always very much appreciated. However, there is a free option, as the most important thing is that this information gets to you, whether you can afford it or not. Now, you can also learn more about Jude Hill by going to her website, sadnesstosunshine.com, and also join her on social media. All the links that you will need are also in the podcast extras when you sign up to that. Now, next week, I have another amazing guest called Karen Wyatt. Karen is the author of 7 Lessons for Living from the Dying. She is amazing. We discussed the first lesson, to embrace your suffering. Now, that doesn't sound like much fun, but it is the first step to courageous joy. The stories that she shares through her book are just absolutely inspiring. I would recommend this conversation to anybody, whether you've lost somebody or not. You will definitely get some inspiration and encouragement from that conversation. So I'm your host of the Good Grief Conversation, and it is always my pleasure to bring these powerful, honest, and sometimes emotional conversations to you. Now, I love to do this because it doesn't only help you, it helps me too. You see, I want you and me to find the courage to live an inspired life and not just to get used to things. So let's keep talking. I look forward to speaking with you next week. And before I go, I'd also like to say a very special thank you to John, who puts all my podcasts together, and to my lovely friend Teo, who has recorded this very special, beautiful, soft music that goes with this show too. So I'm Janet Jones. I'm your host here on UK Health Radio. And also don't forget, we are now available on Alexa. I believe that you just ask her to play UK Health Radio and she will. We're also on all other platforms, or even direct from my website at thegoodgriefconversation.com. Have a fantastic week. I will speak to you soon. Be blessed, take care, and be safe. Bye for now.